programs of excellence in autism and an ACE grant. She's published over 200 papers, not just on autism, but on children with other intellectual disabilities, blind infants. She's made really major contributions to our study, our understanding of imitation in ASD. She helped shape the new diagnostic criteria by being part of the DSM-5 Working Group for Neurodevelopmental Disorders. And she developed one of the major intervention models for young children with autism, the Denver model, and along with Jerry Dawson and other colleagues, is adapting it for, or has adapted it and is continuing to adapt it even for infants and toddlers with autism. On a personal note, Sally was one of my graduate advisors. I started working with her in 1985, and frankly, at first, I was really scared of her. I carried around a notebook, and I wrote down everything she said, honestly verbatim. I was scribing all of her words of wisdom, whether in a personal meeting or even in the clinic, running after her, scurrying after her, and trying to understand autism. She had so much to teach even then, and I would go and pore over my notes at night. But honestly, in a million years at that time, as a scurrying graduate student, I would never have thought I would be up here honoring her and our 30-year collaboration and friendship. So it is really wonderful to be here. And I'm not scared of her anymore, but I am still in awe of her because she's an amazing clinician. I don't know that I've ever met such a talented clinician, but she's also an internationally known researcher. And how often do you really get that blend, that balance? She's so compassionate. I know she receives hundreds of emails from families, and she responds to every single one of them. So this really is her life's work, and we're really, really lucky to have her here telling us about it. So please join me in welcoming her.
Happy to be here today, and okay, that's their problem. Okay, so feedback, we'll get it right. We've got a great team back there. It's nice to be here among all my friends and colleagues in the INFAR and INSAR world and in the autism research world. I'm sorry about that feedback, but I can't control it from up here. They'll tell me what to do. I really want to thank Sally and Jackie and the program committee for this year's fabulous meeting, Bill, who's hosted us in the city that I love, in the state that I love. I want to particularly acknowledge the teams that I've worked with over all these years in autism work, my teams in Denver, the teams at Mind Institute, my colleague Jerry Dawson, with whom I've done so much of the work in the last 10, 15 years of adapting interventions for infants and toddlers. Lori Vismara, who did so much work in moving what our new models were into work directly with parents. If there's something you guys want me to do, you just need to tell me. I don't know, I don't want to mess with my clothes. There are almost 2,000 people out here. You thread all these things under your clothes and it's kind of intimate. Anyway, I want to thank the teams that I've worked with in our multi-site projects, particularly Annette Estes, who's been there with every multi-site we've done and is really such a great colleague, and all the funding sources I've had, various branches from NIH. Yes? See, that's what I mean about intimate.
You have it facing down.
I have it facing down, okay. There we go. Okay. Thank you, sir. That was a little thrill. So, Autism Speaks, thank you. All the foundations that have helped us, the parents and the children who have been our teachers in this whole incredible journey. And I particularly want to thank David Amaral, my friend and colleague at the Mind Institute, who has done so much to make this meeting happen, to make this organization happen, and who really puts an enormous amount of time to foster all of us as a group. He's a very... his interests in autism are deep and broad, and he's such an incredible scientist. We're very lucky to have David as a cheerleader for all of our work. Thank you, David. So 50 years ago last week, Life magazine published an article that dramatically brought autism treatment and autism problems to the lay audience of the American public. In their coverage of the work of Ivar Lovaas at UCLA and his beginning applications of applied behavior analysis to try to teach children with autism needed skills and to help them manage problematic behaviors, he shone an entirely new light on ways of working with people with autism. He introduced the techniques of the time, reward systems, punishment systems. This little girl is standing on a floor that has electric grids through it, which delivers mild electric shocks as a way of punishing problem behavior. These were the tools of the time. These were the best tools we had. And people were using these tools for the first time to address people who seemed to have the least ability to learn, both people with severe intellectual difficulties and people with severe psychiatric impairments. And at this time, he brought a group of young people like me into the interest with autism, which has fueled us, which brought us into treatment and has kept us here all this time. Where were children with autism at the time he was working? They were living in places like this. This is Willowbrook State, quote, school, an institution for 6,000 people with intellectual disability. Few people with autism were even differentially diagnosed at this time. Institutions like this were in every state in our union. They were packed to capacity. I worked in three of these by the time I was 22 years old. And wards like this, children came from the delivery rooms, children with identifiable intellectual problems and genetic problems came from the delivery room to live their lives in wards like this until they could walk, and then into wards like this until they died. This was custodial care. People were segregated, sterilized, and removed from our society. This is our inheritance of the eugenics movement, the idea that genetics is biology, and the unfortunate contributions of IQ testing to this process. I worked in wards exactly like this. This is where I worked. The first four children with autism I met lived like this. And we removed them from the ward, put clothes on them to take them to see how to learn to interact with them. A young Geraldo Roberto in 1972 did a very, very courageous act. He went into Willowbrook with an undercover camera crew, and he filmed. The shots I'm showing you come from his films. And he got it on nightly news in New York City, and it played for a week. And it made us face what we were doing and how we were thinking about people with intellectual and psychiatric disorders. It fueled the movement of deinstitutionalization, and it helped us move from the focus on segregation and separation to the focus on community life for all, in relationships with all. But it took a family member, John F. Kennedy, to move us forward into providing the funds that we needed to study intellectual disability, psychiatric disorder, to begin to move into a framework of education and treatment.
President's remarks on sending mental health and retardation bill to Congress. From the Fish Room of the White House, February 5th, 1963.
I have sent to the Congress today a series of proposals to help fight mental illness and mental retardation. These two afflictions have been long neglected. They occur more frequently, affect more people, require more prolonged treatment, cause more individual and family suffering than any other condition in American life. It has been tolerated too long. It has troubled our national conscience, but only as a problem unpleasant to mention, easy to postpone, and despairing of solution. The time has come for a great national effort. New medical, scientific, and social tools and insights are now available. With respect to mental illness, our chief aim is to get people out of state custodial institutions and back into their communities and homes without hardship or danger. Today, nearly one-fifth
knew that more than 50% of them would never learn to use speech as a primary communication mode. We knew that the intellectual impairments were lifelong. Here is data from two longitudinal studies, one from Kathy Lord and the other from Sigmund and Ruskin's paper, studying large groups of children with autism from the age of 2 through early childhood, 9 to 12. These were children who were born in the 70s. They were receiving public education because we finally had laws that said children with autism should also be educated. And you see here the IQ ranges. I'm sorry, I forgot to switch that. Nope. All right, I got to get my AV straight. Okay. So you see here the IQs in both of these groups at age 2. The children with autism are in blue. The children with intellectual disability in the comparison groups are in green. And we see that in both studies, the initial IQs are in the 40 to 50 range. And across the entire first 10 to 12 years of life, there's almost no movement in either study for children who are in school and receiving education. This are the kind of data that made us feel that intellectual disability was part and parcel of autism in most situations. And so in 1987, when Ivar Lovaas published his first paper on outcomes of a new intervention project involving two-year-olds with autism, this represented a sea change in what could be expected. He assigned 19 children who were a mean age of about 32 months to an intensive applied behavior intervention in which university students were taught to use ABA techniques. They went to children's homes and they worked with them for 30 to 40 hours a week, teaching them intensively language skills, all the skills that they needed to learn. The comparison group were children who had also been referred to the clinic. There were no therapists for treatment, and so these children got a greatly reduced number of hours of treatment. And you see in these data that the comparison group these children begin with IQs in the 40 to 50 range, like I've just shown you. The comparison group makes very little gain from age 2 to age 13. The group that received treatment made a massive gain in IQ as a group, 30 points of gain by the time they're 7 to 8, which they maintain. Their treatment ends somewhere in this 5 to 8 period. And they maintain this level of performance within the normal range of intellectual ability for this entire period. 49% of these children were in regular schools without needing any special services, without any diagnosis, and without any problems that were impairing them from functioning in everyday situations. At age 13, this group had much, much better daily living skills, social skills, and everyday environments, according to their parents, than did the comparison group. This paper was met with disbelief. I think that's fair, in the autism community. And there were a series of papers following it, wondering how in the method and the selection, et cetera, this could come to be. For young researchers in early intervention like me, this was like a lightning bolt. It changed everything about what we were now working for. It offered us an entirely new set of goals for what we should be working towards in our work with young children with autism. The disbelief settled down when Tris Smith published his randomized controlled trial replicating the finding of significant increases in IQ in a group of children who were even more intellectually impaired than these children, with mean IQs in the 40s in the beginning, showing much greater IQ gain in the children receiving the treatment than children who were receiving typical community care, although he did not report the level of recovery that Lovaas reported. And from that point forward, there have been many studies of Lovaas's use of applied behavior analysis. This is a meta-analysis of replications of that approach by Rykow and Wohler, published in 2009. The main effect size is 0.69. And this is considered, I think this is the best studied and very well-established effective treatment for young children with autism. I want you to take a look, for those of you who haven't seen this kind of therapy. This is a video in my lab. We're studying discrete trial teaching as a comparison right now. John McCacken is supervising all the work, and I just wanted you to be able to see what this looks like.
Find it. Nice, that's the Vaseline. Good boy. Look. Talking for you. Where is it? Nice, that's the ball. Awesome. Here, put it on. Good job, buddy. Copy me. Yeah, that's it. Do this. Awesome. Great work, buddy. Oh, yeah, that's my watch. Nice job, Token.
So the science of applied behavior analysis, the science of learning, offered us very important new tools. However, there is another huge progress in science in the 60s to the 80s, which has also had a tremendous influence on early intervention in autism. And that was the work in developmental psychology, which was discovering new ways of understanding infant and toddler development, the development of relationships, of social interactions, and the precursors of language development in infants. And so these new tools could address the question about whether young children with autism were on a different developmental trajectory, which was the assumption at the time. They developed very differently, they learned very differently, they needed a very different kind of intervention. But the new tools of developmental psychology could actually ask that as a scientific question. And we had a series of publications that actually laid the groundwork for a very different way of thinking. Helen Tagger-Flussberg published a paper demonstrating the very typical progression into speech, much more similar than different for a group of young children with autism studied very carefully in their language onset period. Judy Unger and Marion Sigmund described the stages of development of object play using a Piagetian framework and demonstrated that young children with autism followed the same kinds of steps as they progressed that both typically developing children do. Even the area of pretend play, which we know is extremely difficult for young children with autism, Unger and Sigmund demonstrated that once children with autism were entering that, they did start to enter it in the way other children did. And Karen Lifter did a very nice single subject design demonstrating the importance of following developmental trajectories as we teach pretend play. Catherine DeMeyer in the 70s was looking at imitation and demonstrating that young children with autism did follow typical patterns of development of imitation skills. And cognitive skills in terms of sensory motor development were also laid out in a Piagetian framework by Sigmund and Ungerer. Only in the area of joint attention, of all these primary areas of difficulty for children with autism, only in joint attention is there the sense that children with autism learn the joint attention format in a somewhat different order than do typically developing children. Amy Weatherby contributed tremendously to that work and still does. And so with this advent of bringing developmental science into the treatment of children with autism, we now had much more of a sense of what we should be teaching children and how we should be helping them pick up the developmental skills that they so badly needed. I was working in a developmental model at the time. I had funding from the Department of Education to develop a developmental model, and I was working in a preschool setting doing experimental work and treatment work, developing approaches for very young children ages 2 through 4 in Denver. And at the same time, Jerry Dawson was at the University of Washington doing elegant treatment experiments, looking at the different kinds of behaviors that adults could have and the effect that that had on children's responses in a therapeutic situation, both with parents as therapists and experimentalists as therapists. And so Jerry and I came together, thanks to her invitation, for me to join her in her START Center. And in around 2005, we brought together our work
and moved Denver model enhanced by applied behavior analysis skills learned by the PRT folks who were in her lab at the time to create the Early Start Denver model, which to address the needs of children as young as 12 months with autism. And Early Start Denver model, or ESDM, brought something, mostly it's the things we always knew but packaged real well, I think, but there were some new ideas here as well. And I think one of the things we accomplished well in this was a real fusion, not just a marriage of applied behavior analysis and developmental science, like Laura said yesterday, but it's really a fusion. It's more like, well, never mind, that'll be a little risque to say. But anyway, this I was going to say the intercourse of applied behavior analysis and developmental approaches, so that it really became one, completely joined, completely together in the way of teaching and working with children. That's a foundation of this approach. This is also a comprehensive intervention. Autism affects every developmental area in a young child's life. And if we want to deal with the whole child, we have to deal with all aspects, all domains of development. And ESDM does assess and develop very targeted skills right within children's zones of proximal development, right on the cusp of what they're ready to learn in all of their developmental areas. And of course, when you're working in all developmental domains, you need all the disciplinary expertise you can get. This is an interdisciplinary approach with an interdisciplinary team behind every child and main therapist. This is an empirically supported study, and it is a database study. It uses evidence-based techniques, and we collect data and use not trial by trial, but interval by interval data throughout intervention sessions to inform and further individualize the treatment within a manualized, systematic approach. And this is one of the naturalistic developmental behavioral interventions that Laura Scheibman described yesterday. Okay. So the model that we were working from as we were thinking about what we were intending to do, what we felt needed to be done, was a model that was laid out by both Peter Mundy and Jerry Dawson in the latter half of the 1990s. And this provides a way of thinking about what is happening in early autism when the symptoms we first see is this kind of social disconnect of toddlers with their family members. The model that these two brilliant colleagues laid out was that the biology of autism affected the infant's salience of social stimuli for them. Maybe not at the very beginning of life, as the infant studies have shown us, but early on in infancy, children stop demonstrating that people hold so much interest for them. They seem not so motivated to look, to interact, to initiate and get interactions going. They seem to be not so rewarded by social attention, and they are very interested in the object world. And as babies become able to ambulate and move where they want to move, what we see is that infants with autism are moving away from the family circle and into the world of objects and lint on the floor and cords and things that are out in the periphery of the social environment. And in watching what autism does, we see that the children are losing the social learning opportunities, which is what fuels infant-toddler development. They are not inside the interactions that are going on among family members. They are outside of that, and they are missing massive numbers of learning opportunities that most toddlers are pulling out of their families by being constantly underfoot and constantly initiating interaction. And so this kind of deprivation of learning caused by the symptoms of autism is increasing the deficient repertoires over time, as young children with autism are having fewer and fewer learning experiences. But when we bring in the concepts of infant plasticity and the idea that brain is very much shaped by experience, and that these infant and toddler experiences are critical features in shaping brain to function, to be the social, communicative, linguistic, interactive kind of people that we are, we understand that this change in learning and this change in orientation of the infant is also having feedback into their developing neural systems, neural networks, and brain specialization. And so they may very well be evolving different patterns for the way that they are thinking and processing environment. The differences we see in fMRIs in later life in people with ASD may not reflect only the biology of ASD. It may reflect the years and years of experience in thinking and looking at things differently. And so in our interventions, this is the process that we wanted to intervene with. We wanted to make sure that young children with autism were inside the family back and forth, that they re-engaged in these constant learning opportunities that are available in family life and in interpersonal interaction. And we wanted to fill in as much as we could the missed opportunities that they'd already experienced while they were as young as possible, and the gaps between them and their peers were less. And we wanted to be using typical developmental processes and typical developmental experiences so that infants could perhaps be moved back into a more typical trajectory and be able to have these kinds of experiences that would provide them with the neural networks and the brain development that would support more growth and learning in the areas of language and social interaction. We looked at all waking hours as learning opportunities, and we wanted an intervention that was so flexible that it could be delivered anywhere by anyone, in preschools with other children present, typically developing children present, in the grocery store as mom is shopping with the baby in the cart, at playing games with the family members at the kitchen table, out on the swing set in the backyard or at the park with parents and siblings, and in everyday routines which parents are carrying out. We need interventions that fit into daily routines because that's where infants learn, in the day-to-day repetition of language, interactions, and routines. That is the learning, that's the Petri dish for little children's development. And we didn't feel like we could create a better learning situation for them than that. And so we built out a set of principles for interaction with young children that anyone could use. And they included building activities, both play activities and daily activities, in a particular kind of way with clean beginnings, a very clear theme, variations on that theme, and clear closings for children. So they started to understand the shape of activities of daily life, using child-preferred activities to interest children, bring them into interaction with us, and make sure that they were interested in what was going on. Capturing and holding child attention in this part of the body where all the messages are, getting close and making sure that children were here inside this zone where we thought emotion and interpersonal connection travels best through. We wanted to see positive affect, both in child and adult, permeate the experience. And we worked for balanced interactions in which both the child and the adult or partner both lead and both follow. It's a balanced, reciprocal, turn-taking kind of exchange where children are fostered to initiate as well as to respond to others, in which adults are following as well as leading. We were finding many, many, many ways to get learning opportunities in. And a skilled parent or ESDM therapist delivers a learning opportunity about every 10 seconds in an exchange. I'll show you that in a minute. And finally, we wanted adults who were sensitive and responsive to children's cues, to their feelings, could let them know that they were heard. Because happy children with happy adults in a situation where children feel understood and in which they have activities they like bring children near. They want proximity, and they're close by. And then they're in a range where we can do more teaching. So all of these things were operating, we thought, together to create a therapeutic situation for them in which it might maximize their learning opportunities. And I want to show you the progress of one little boy inside this kind of frame. This is a 22-month-old who has just begun in our center. This is one of our first meetings with him. He has no speech. He has no appropriate play skills. He is very difficult to interact with his parents and his siblings. It's a lot of negative affect, a lot of arousal. He's very hard to calm. This is just a little window into his starting state.
Like the doll.
More. There you go.
new activity and see if he'll talk to you for a few minutes, something else. Or we can just kind of hang out with mom too.
All done?
What do you think? Okay, so today's topic is... Awesome.
Bismarck. She's working with the parents and just has a little interaction on the side going on with him, which shows what he's really capable of when we can create a different kind of state for him.
Come get.
You know, today Dr. Chef's office, he took out the, what's it called?
Reflex hammer.
He took out his reflex hammer and he did Colson's knees. And then, down.
I'm trying to get Sam's in.
Down.
Like at the beginning of it. This is the kind of interaction we want to create, and these are the effects of developing this kind of playful, reciprocal, balanced interaction with children.
Oh. Happy the smile you see upon my face as the sun shines in the sky shows the world that I feel happy and my mood is soaring high. Look, I see something that's red and yellow and it smells good.
The flowers.
The flowers, yeah. That's it. I see something big and yellow and it's hot.
The sun,
yeah. Sometimes I feel so very sad and really don't know why. Instead of playing and having fun, I cry and cry. And cry. Oh, thanks, big guy. Can you show me a sad face? What does it look like when you're sad?
He's really okay. He's okay.
He'll be okay. Can you show me what you look like when you're sad? Show me sad. It's okay, Colson.
It's okay.
Yeah, you're
emotion
just fine.
Contagion.
We're not really sad. We're
comforting the adult, all spontaneous, just in the moment. He was receiving 15 hours a week of ESDM in our first ACE study. That's a college level, a BA level therapist who's quite new to our group right then. So this is what ESDM looks like as it proceeds into all kinds of daily activities, but with the same kind of back and forth quality, the same shared kind of pleasure, close proximity gaze. So Jerry Dawson published the paper from the first ESDM study from her START Center in 2010, in which she demonstrated in this group of 48 children who were randomized, 24 to ESDM, 24 to community care, the mean age of the children was about 24 months at the time of entry. They were between 18 and 30 months. They had at least an IQ of 35, and they did not have major health impairments. But other than that, this represented a very wide range of children. You see here that at the beginning of the study, had a mean IQ, both groups of children had a mean IQ of about 60. We delivered 15 hours a week of ESDM in their homes by trained paraprofessional staff backed up by an interdisciplinary team. We provided parent training, we called it at the time, and PRT every other week throughout the period of the study. The parents reported using their techniques about 5 hours a week. The comparison children were enrolled in treatment and averaged about 16 to 17 hours a week of treatment in Seattle. So there is very little difference in number of hours that are being delivered to these children. There's a large difference in curriculum. So at the end of 12 months of this study, it was a two-year study for the children, there's a significant change, difference in IQ. And by 2 years out, there was the children in the ESDM group had gained almost 20 IQ points. The children in the community group had gained 6 IQ points. these are significantly different. We found these effects not only in IQ, but we also found it in both in expressive and receptive language. Children in the ESDM group made almost 2 standard deviations of growth in their language abilities. The children in the comparison group were significantly below the children with the ESDM after 2 years. And parents reported that their children, in terms of their children's skill use in everyday activities at home on the Vineland scale, the ESDM children showed a significant advantage in their Vineland skills overall and also in specific areas. So we demonstrated the effects of this study on this group of children. And recently, Giacomo Vivanti has published a replication in a very well-controlled study in Australia of ESDM delivered in daycare settings to a group. There are almost 50 children in this study. It's not a randomized controlled trial, but it's a very well-matched comparison group. 27 children with autism at about a mean age of 40 months were assigned to an ESDM-based daycare center at La Trobe University. Cheryl DeSaniaco was the faculty member overseeing this work. And 30 children were the comparison group. They were in an autism specialty program supported by the Australian government, which is using very up-to-date eclectic practices. Giacomo has demonstrated here that there is a significant ESDM IQ gain after 12 months in the daycare setting, where the ratio is 1 to 4, one adult to 4 children with autism. And that we have more than a 10-point, almost a full standard deviation of IQ gain in 1 year, and significant differences with the comparison group. Also significantly faster, better trajectories on adaptive behavior in the ESDM group than the comparison group, and significant improvements in receptive language compared to the community group. 95% of the children in this ESDM group were verbal at the end of 1 year. In Jerry's study in Seattle, 88% of the children were verbal, and I mean multi-word speech, spontaneous and functional by the age of 4 years, by their 4th birthday. So there are massive effects on language development in this intervention. Now, Jerry published a very important paper a couple of years ago. Time Magazine recognized this as one of the top 5 scientific findings in the year in 2012. And this was a study of event-related brain potentials looking at automatic responses to faces versus objects. In this study, which occurred at the point that the ESDM children had just finished treatment, so the community group and the ESDM experimental group were at the end of 2 years of treatment. She also recruited a group of typically developing 4-year-olds to serve as comparison group. And the children looked at, they wore this net of electrodes, and they looked at a computer screen showing color photos of women's faces or toys. The children looked at 100 photos randomly distributed between those 2 stimuli as we collected the data. Here's the data from the typically developing children. They're showing a much faster and larger response to faces than to objects. Here's the data from the ESDM-treated children. They are showing a response that is identical to the typically developing children, a faster, stronger response to faces than to objects. Here are the community-treated children who are showing the opposite pattern, the pattern that Jerry had previously shown was associated with autism, a faster, stronger response to objects than to faces. So in this piece of data, which I believe is the first study of biological brain responses to a behavioral treatment in autism, we see that the data demonstrate that this therapy seems to have accomplished what we set out trying to do, to recreate this automatic salience and preference for people and for social experience, and to increase the reward value of social interactions, which we feel is so important to helping children with autism orient to the social world and learn from them. And then in a brand new paper, which has just been published in the last month, Annette Estes provided follow-up data on the children from this first study. These are data 2 years after the end of treatment, when the children are 6 to 7. And she was able to find most of the children, 24 of the 25 children are represented in this study. And here you see two important things. First of all, the ESDM children, after leaving ESDM and going into whatever services or programs, not necessarily services, they participate in, they make another 10 points of gain in their standard scores. So their mean IQ is now 95. Their mean language skill is now 100. And their violence skills are also within the normal range. The community treatment group also makes gains, but there continues to be a significant ESDM advantage. It approaches significance for overall IQ. It is significant for nonverbal behavior, for adaptive behavior composites, for social skills measured on the Vineland, and significantly lower ADOS scores, milder symptoms in all domains, repetitive behavior, social affect, and total ADOS score. So this effect, which we did not see at age 4 on the ADOS scores, although we saw it in other measures, we see now that the kind of the long-term effects of ESDM are working directly on autism symptoms as well as on learning. And the children in the ESDM group got significantly less special services from age 4 to this point than did the community group. They're more taking more of regular community activities, typical preschools, typical play groups. The children in the community group are now using many more specialized services than were the ESDM children. I want you to see this boy you've been meeting at this age. He's now 7 and has just finished first grade. And this is the ADOS in a conversation probe.
Maybe November break?
Probably. I don't know.
Hey, do you know that I haven't been to Disneyland yet?
Me either.
You haven't?
No.
It's very exciting, huh?
I know. We're going in the one in Los Angeles.
Oh, and so some people fly there and some people drive their car there.
We're going to drive there.
Yeah?
5.5 hours.
That's not
a lot.
That's not too bad, huh?
No.
No.
Not too bad. And 2 days is.
And all the things you have to look forward to when you're riding in the car, right?
Yeah.
When you get there.
Yeah, we're going to look for license plates.
License plates?
Yeah.
Yeah. You can play cool games in the car, right?
We could do, like, we're going to look for a license plate, and then if we haven't spotted it yet, then we can check it off.
Right. We can. You can also play I Spot.
He has no intellectual deficits. He has no linguistic deficits. He has no difficulties in functioning in any typical environment. He's in regular school without special services. He has a diagnosis, and it's attention deficit disorder. He gets along well with peers. He gets along very well in his family. This little boy doesn't have any particular impairments or any limitations from participating in any activity any other 7-year-old does. And if there's one thing I want you to take out of my talk today is that he is not an unusual outcome. He is an average outcome in our current studies, in the last 3 of our current studies. This can be accomplished, and it can be accomplished by the time children are entering school. And certainly, children's starting points have an effect on how far they're going to go in terms of their changes. But Jerry's data, which are not yet published, demonstrate that initial IQ and language do not moderate the effects of ESDM on IQ and language growth. Children who start with more impairment gain, compared to their baseline, as much. They accelerate as much as do the children who start at higher points. Only severity of IQ moderated the IQ effect of ESDM in the original studies, but it still, even though it moderates the effect of IQ, the children getting ESDM, even those with the most severe autism, showed hugely greater increases in their scores than did the community children. So this is an effective intervention for children across the spectrum of autism as we have studied it thus far. Children who have an initial IQ of 35 and who do not have other kinds of genetic disorders. We have not tested it yet in a controlled way in other disorders, but Lori Bismar is doing that work right now. So, what's going on here? How is this happening? And with only 15 hours of treatment delivered by others instead of 40. Well, I think there are a couple things going on. First of all, I think that these data support this idea that there is an experiential deficit going on, and that some of the delay that we see when we first meet a young child with autism is a secondary effect of what autism has already created in their experience from the time it's onset until the time they're in the clinic, which hopefully is not so long, but tragically is often years and years. And so this supports the idea that there is this experiential deficit, which is based on a loss of learning experiences, and that an enriched learning situation may be able to address that. We know that's true in children who have other kinds of social deprivation or learning deprivation experiences, and this could be supporting that. And I think that some of the data from the infant sibling study also supports that idea. These are data from Sally Ozenoff's work in infant siblings of children with autism. And these are developmental quotient data from her sample of 48 infants who are siblings who go on to develop autism across the first 3 years of life. What you see here is that at age 6 months, these children are developmentally quite typical. Their scores are not different from comparison children's. But by 12 months, they've already demonstrated almost three-quarters of a standard deviation of deceleration in their learning rates, and they are now significantly different from comparisons. And by 18 months, their average DQ is now 75, and at 24 months, their average DQ is now down here around 50. And I've now mashed the longitudinal data from Lord and Sigmund onto this, looking at the typical course from this point across the rest of childhood, which would look like this. But if we put the intervention data that I've just shown you on top of this file, then we see this. We see this onset period in which the symptoms of autism are coming on and children's learning is decelerating. And this is not due to regression. Not one child in Sally's sample lost any skills. This is a slowing down of developmental rates, which we're hypothesizing is due to the isolating effects of their symptoms. And so if intervention can start here, now these are data from the intervention studies mashed onto this, that what we see is this slow increase again in learning rates. I think of this as acceleration of learning rate. To a point out here, here's the end of our treatment data, and now I've mashed the follow-up data onto this, so that we see quite a bit of recovery here. And that's what I'm hypothesizing is happening, that we're being able to manage this experiential deficit. But if we're going to do that, we want to do it in here. You know, the faster we can get to the point of deceleration, the smaller the gap is that we have to fill, the more maximized the infant plasticity is, and the less the child with autism has had time to develop other ways of functioning in the world. We need this to be happening here. And that means we need to be working with parents. We cannot do all of this work through therapists. It shouldn't be done with 12 and 18-month-olds, with strangers. That doesn't fit what we know about attachment relations. And so I want to show you the kind of work a parent can do. And I also, you're going to be able to see what I'm talking about in terms of the isolating effects of autism. This is a 24-month-old. He has a few echoed words at the time we've met him. He's a very self-sufficient boy. He is calm. He is quiet. He loves objects. He has his own way of doing things. And he's not very present in his family. He's very self-contained. And this is our first meeting and our first interview. I want you to watch how many initiations the parents make and how the child responds to them.
He does, yeah. Not always in response to how many, but like you can do 1, 2, 3.
Yeah,
he can go up to 10, but it's a little hit and miss. Like 4 is 2. 1, 2, 3, 2, 5.
Yay!
I got 1, 2. I got 1, 2. You got both of them now.
Oh.
Okay. The string
is it like a stretchy?
Oh.
Oh.
people in the truck.
Okay, so this family then entered a parent training, a parent coaching study of ours. Lori was managing this study and wrote the grant for it. And in this intervention, this is ESDM delivered to parents. The mom has come one time a week with the child for an hour and worked with actually Costanza Colombi, who is the therapist in the chair right here. And so this is week six. He's had 6 hours of parent coaching with mom, and she goes home at night and she shares with dad what she's learned and the materials. Well, this particular week, mom was ill, so dad came in. And we haven't seen dad since that video I just showed you. So we asked dad to show us, how's it going with you and Dean? And this is what we saw. Is transferred from mom to dad. This is 6 hours of treatment is all that's gone on here, and all the work is being done by the parents. Even without coaching, dad has picked up the skills from watching his wife and is using them beautifully, and it is an entirely different situation, isn't it? With dad is delivering a learning opportunity more than every 10 seconds here. The child is imitating every word, or trying basically to imitate every clear single word dad's delivering. There's no particular instruction to do. This is a spontaneous behavior of the child, spontaneous initiations, eye contact for communication, completely joined together on this activity in every bit of it. This is what we're trying to accomplish. This is what we think is a useful way of helping young children with autism. And Amy Weatherby recently has published data showing that this kind of an approach with parents delivering the intervention can also be very effective in accelerating their growth. These are Amy's data, and she demonstrated that in her intervention, which is called early social interaction, it's another one of the NDBIs, she randomized 82 children into either ESI, delivered a one-to-one for 3 hours a week at home visits, taught to parents and parents coached in it to carry on at home, or she randomized the other group to a group teaching of ESI, which met once a week. And after 9 months, she has a significantly more acceleration in developmental quotient overall in the children who received ESI, a significantly difference in receptive language skills, a non-significant improvement in expressive language, and significant gain, again, in adaptive behavior in everyday life. This is completely parent-delivered, and it's being carried out in-home through through home visits and a minimal amount of intervention. And so parents have to be and are superb not even therapists, they're just wonderful teachers of their young children, for typically developing children and for children with ASD. They need some help with tools sometimes, and with the idea of persisting and increasing attention. And those are the things that we're helping them with. So we hope that we can begin sooner. The infant work is helping us identify children sooner and sooner, and we hope that we will be able to begin before this deceleration happens so fully in young children with autism, but this awaits diagnostic tools. So what variables do I think is going on? Paul Yoder said the other day that clinical experience is a legitimate source of information. So from my clinical experience, what do I think is going on here in my developmental training? First of all, I think that we're working in a time in which the autism phenotype is just emerging. We're working very close to onset. Onset is a long, protracted period that goes on, as the infant SIB data have shown us, over a year or more. And I think of this as a period of disorganization and reorganization for the children. And stepping into a disorganized system is a time of particular flexibility. So I feel like we are working at a point in which the onset of autism is at a very flexible point, as is infant toddler development and brain development. And that's working for us, younger and younger. I think another thing that's working for us, my guess would be, that we're teaching age-appropriate skills at the time the children are that age. We're teaching language to one-year-olds at the time when I assume the neural systems that are going to support it are maximally ready for the input. We're teaching imitation, joint attention, reciprocal responsiveness, language and gesture, still inside the normal period that these should be occurring. And I think there's probably increased power to be teaching at that time because of the uptake ability, the readiness of the child's neural system for this kind of learning. I think the positive emotion is a critical feature of what we're doing. I think that positive emotion from children are catching it from the adult. It brings eyes together. It brings bodies together. It holds children's attention. It has them looking to us to add the fun, to make it more interesting. And I think this combination of positive emotion and being very close, so that the emotions really, you can see the emotional contagion going on in these close face-to-face experiences. And you all know from your own experience that when you are close, face-to-face, and quite near someone that you are intimately involved with, the transmission of emotion back and forth is effortless. And I think we are using that here, the emotional contagion process, to develop this kind of link that allows learning to occur. And I think this capturing of social attention in the flow of positive emotion and holding children's attention to this part of our bodies is actually activating the entire resonating system. Imitation, joint attention, these I think are together, and I'm thinking of them as the neural networks that allow for observational learning or social learning. I think of this as a whole system, and I think that these processes, these social emotional processes, are activating this entire system. And we actually have nice data demonstrating that these, what we think of as the four most difficult areas for a young child with autism to learn, joint attention, symbolic play, imitation, and language, these are not four separate abilities. The data have demonstrated to us, if you target joint attention in a targeted intervention, you also get collateral effects on language, both receptive and expressive. Connie Kazzer and Chris Whalen showed us that. And if you target joint attention as an intervention, you get effects on symbolic play. Connie showed us that, and so did Danielle Thorpe. And if you target imitation as a target, you get effects on joint attention collaterally. And if you target imitation as an intervention, you get collateral effects on symbolic play. Brooke Ingersoll has shown us that. And you get effects on receptive and expressive language. And if you target symbolic play, you get collateral effects on language. Connie showed us that. These are not separate systems. These are linked together, and this is the foundation of infant-toddler learning. These are the social learning tools that allow typically developing infants and toddlers to become like little geniuses in language in the first few years of life. And these are the systems that young children have. Young children with autism, they have these systems, but they're kind of like the sounds turned down. I think about it as this is volume control. And we can bring this volume up. We can get these systems resonating. And through that, then we can get this rapid exposure to learning, which if it's targeted very closely to what the child is ready to learn, I think then we get these rapid progressions in learning in all domains, regardless of what the child's starting point is. And so back to the variables I think are important. I think this targeted learning is very important, that we need to be identifying what the child is right at the cusp of, because we know that teaching within Vygotsky's proximal zone of development helps children move to the next level, acquire skills more rapidly. And we are doing massive enrichment. We are filling in many, many learning opportunities here. But as you can see in these videos, I don't think it looks weird. I don't think it looks overly intense. It's just a very tight flow of adult and child together communicating. And this rate of interaction is certainly what my chatty toddlers managed to pull out of me when they were young. So I think that we are still within a kind of a typical way of interacting, but making sure that we are really milking every opportunity for chances to bring children into the opportunity and expose them to new learning. I also think the follow-up data is showing us that once these systems, once these foundation skills are in place and children are initiating, learning from other people, asking questions, sharing their experiences, that they now have the tools to be constructivist learners, that there's a kind of a self-writing that has gone on. And so we see Jerry's ESDM kids from Washington going off into typical settings and continuing to accelerate their learning rates from typical environments, taking needed learning experiences that they themselves are finding and growing from. So I think we may be moving into self-writing experiences, which we see in other groups of children who have experiential deficits for some reason or another. And so this gets to, I think, an important question that David and I have talked about some. Are we talking about compensatory processes here that we're managing to stimulate in early autism? Or are we talking about actually being able to engage and the systems that would be engaged as well in these kinds of learning if the child did not have autism? This may, in fact, be ways to stimulate growth in typical neural networks, leading towards typical brain activities. We need the imaging data, and we need the brain data for this. But Jerry's EEG data shows us that may well be true. And so I think we need to consider that we may be able to kind of tune up, turn the volume up on typical learning processes and typical ways of brain development occurring in early childhood. So if this can happen for young children with autism, then what is it going to take? David Mandel presented these data last year. These are cost-benefit data based on the ESDM sample at University of Washington. The ESDM children are in blue and the community children are in purple. And this is the point in which intervention started. And this is 2 years later when the intervention in Jerry's group stopped. And what you see here is that from the time these children are born, parents, we got reports on all the data, all the interventions and professional contacts parents had had in any kind of service delivery system. And so we then turned that into dollars and are looking at this in terms of comparisons. And we see that up until the ending of ESDM treatment, more money has been spent on the ESDM children's treatment than on the children in the community. However, at the point that ESDM is finished, at that point, the story changes. And there are more public funds now being spent on the community treatment group on the ESDM group. Because remember I told you the ESDM group are uptaking fewer services. But they're uptaking fewer services. They're also, they've progressed farther. They're more skilled in their academic learning, their social learning, and their language learning. And the projections are that this is going to continue and increase year by year by year. I mean, this is only age 5 right here. And we already have a cost-benefit gain from doing this intervention in this period of time. When I saw these data from David, I was absolutely stunned. I assumed that the cost-benefit recovery would be in adulthood, when adults with autism could be working independently, living independently, paying tax dollars, and not needing so much public assistance. But it's not at age 32, it's at age 5. How do we as autism scientists, what can we do? How does this challenge all of us, regardless of the kinds of science that we are doing? Well, first of all, it cannot take 15 years to get from intervention science to community. That's an entire another generation of children with autism. We have got to move much more rapidly to the community, and we have got to be thinking about delivery of autism interventions by people who are not incredibly skilled and incredibly specialized. Parents can learn these techniques, and they learn them in 8 hours. People who are working with children with autism in a variety of settings can learn these techniques too. And we have got to put focus on, I think, regular community folks and parents who are interacting with children with autism every day. If we do that, it also supports children with autism being in inclusive environments with everybody and not needing to be in specialized, and specialized often means segregated settings. We've got to get into the community. And I think another thing that we can all do is to think about personal commitments. I know Marion Sigmund and I once had this dialogue where she said, Sally, you're so lucky. You get to change kids' lives. And this was before she was doing intervention work. And she said, I wish I knew that my time was also changing lives. And I thought about that a lot because I thought about how many different ways there are to help people with autism. You know, through advocacy, through fundraising, through volunteerism, through social supports, through fostering inclusion, inclusion in our children's schools and daycare centers, inclusion in our workplaces, social supports for people with autism. If there's people with autism in your job, do you know them by name? Do they know you by name? Have you had coffee with them? Are you part of their informal friendship network? There are so many adults with autism who want so much to connect with other people, and we are all here, and we are committed to these folks and committed to their quality of lives. I think probably every person in this room can find an additional way to support the quality of life of people and families with autism. And so to end with a wonderful quote from the Autism Self-Advocates Group, awareness is important, but awareness is not enough. Action is needed. Thank you so much.